free, we need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. The number to call in during this live broadcast is 1-800-858-6582. If you have unlimited long distance or are calling from a cell phone, please use our toll number, 1-559-733-5161. That's 1-559-733-5161. Thank you.
Of American Exposé. This is Chris Gerner is talking to you on the 11th of August, apparently. We're at the 11th. It's a live show Wednesday night. Oh, boy. Much happening, much going on. Last night I seemed to be tuned into the Showtime channel, and I saw this. I believe it's called The American Candidate, which I haven't been following at all. But my gosh, people, listening to Joyce Riley discussing her platform and things, it sounded just like me in many respects. It sounded just like, you know, bring our troops home, bring the jobs home, da-da-da-da-da-da. No mention of the United Nations, however. But the people she's up against don't have a chance to compete against her. I rarely ever make predictions. But I predict this one. She's going to win. Joyce Riley's going to win this American Candidate. Whatever. I think it's $200,000, and I don't know what goes with it. But Linda Kennedy's done, spent the time. She's done the website. She's informed America about her trepidations about Joyce Riley, spending 9 months with her and Dave Von Kleist. You just can't dispel that. You can't dispel it. That's why it's on the website, our website, AmericanExpose.com. I don't trust very many people anymore, and I certainly don't trust Joyce Riley. And I would love to have her come on the show and defend herself. I'd love to have her come on the show and chastise me for what I'm saying right now. But she's not going to do it. And if this network grows, and the contingency for this network growing is the sound quality. That's the key to any network working, is the sound quality. And I don't pay attention to that because I'm 8 years into this, you know? I mean, after a period of time, you have a certain amount of disappointments, and then you are numb to the whole thing. And I've certainly had my share of disappointments over the years about what's going on and the amount of listenership and this and that. It's beyond me to be concerned anymore. And Tim, the guest didn't call in, and your information that you might have, you're welcome to call in tonight. There's so much going on that isn't being covered and isn't being talked about. But let's start off tonight with a joke. Oh boy. It's a golf joke. To celebrate their 50th anniversary, a husband booked a round of golf for his wife and himself on a trip to the famous old St. Andrews golf course in Scotland. On the third tee, the husband hesitated in teeing off and turned slowly to his wife and said, contritely, "Darling, I have to confess something. 20 years ago, I had a brief affair. It meant nothing. I hope you can forgive me." His wife was hurt, but said, "Dearest, those days are long gone. What we have now is far more valuable, and I forgive you." On the 17th tee, the husband was starting his swing when the wife blurted out, "I'm sorry, darling. I have been so conscience-stricken since you told me, but since we are being honest with each other, I have something to tell you also. 52 years ago, I had a sex change operation. I was a man before I met you, and I hope you can forgive me." The husband froze at the top of his backswing, then threw a fit. He slammed the driver into the ground, kicked the cart over on its left side, broke the rest of his clubs one by one, then started off on his wife's clubs. He screamed and ranted, "You liar, you cheat, you despicable deceiver. How could you? I trusted you with my heart and soul. In all these years, you've been playing from the ladies' tees." I thought that was pretty good. I thought that was pretty good. But back to this American candidate situation, I think that's what it's called. As I just caught it last night at 1 in the morning. It's going to be on again Sunday night at 9 o'clock Central, I believe. I predict Joyce Riley is going to win this thing hands down. I don't know who she is. I really don't know what to say other than it appears that she's on the other side. And it just sounded just like Ronald Reagan when he was trying to run for presidency in 1979. All the right things were coming out of his mouth, just like all the right things were coming out of Joyce Riley's mouth, except nothing connected to the UN, but bring our troops home, the Gulf War illness, yeah, naturally, bring the jobs home. Unfortunately, listeners, none of that is ever going to happen unless we get out of the United Nations, unless the United Nations is stopped, unless we stop the Federal Reserve System, unless we stop this international banking fiasco and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, of which our Secretary of the Treasury is the U.S. Governor, nothing is going to change. So when politicians or people acting like politicians want to get your vote, they're going to say the right thing, just like Ronald Reagan said the right thing in 79, just like Joyce Riley said the right thing last night on this American candidate, I believe. But the propaganda and whatever they say to get elected is what they're going to say. But once they're in office, it never changes, does it? And that is the point of the problem. Now, Aaron's here tonight. Feedback, information, thought patterns, complaints, criticisms, anything is welcome tonight. And I know, yeah, you want the information, sure you do. But it's so easy to draw the line to what's going on today. It's so easy to document what the hell's going on. It's so easy to see what's happening if you have the picture in place. If you connect the dots to the State Department, and certainly the websites are all there for you to peruse and see. How many of you heard of the Global Vision Planning Manual? provides the conceptual framework for the Global Vision Project, an international educational media campaign to promote the concept of sustainability as a global goal. The project is being co-produced by Global Vision Corporation, a non-governmental organization, I've heard of those before, haven't you? Accredited to the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development, the CSD. How many of you ever heard of this? How many of you are paying attention to it? How many talk show hosts out there are talking about this Global Vision Planning Manual? Once again, I'm going to repeat this. This Global Vision Planning Manual provides the conceptual framework for the Global Vision Project, an international educational media campaign to promote the concept of sustainability as a global goal. The project is being co-produced by Global Vision Corporation, a non-governmental organization accredited to the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development, and its European twin, the Global Vision Trust, in cooperation with a network of international partners and sponsors. The conceptual framework was designed to facilitate a worldwide participatory planning process for the project's various media projects, especially the information content of the Global Vision feature film, conceived as a collective self-portrait of humankind and the biosphere. This participatory planning process involves a broad variety of partners, including United Nations agencies, non-governmental organizations, universities, institutes, socially responsible corporations, religious institutions, professional associations, teachers, students, and leading thinkers from around the world. The aim of this manual is to provide this extraordinary, knowledgeable network of individuals and organizations with a means to combine our insights, integrate our outreach, and deliver our message of a positive future more effectively to the global public. Now keep in mind, we've had wars, catastrophes, you have weather modification, which is a reality, you have the creation of the wars, which is a reality, you have all the various wars that have started in this country, or started by this country, to get us into World War One, to get us into World War Two. The Korean War was a continuing mess of the Soviet Union creating the Communist China, and the State Department sat back and let it happen. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was the Vietnam War. Joyce Riley even mentioned the POWs from Vietnam last night. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. She's going to win this thing hands down. And is it designed for her to win? That's the question I ask. Because those in control have to find people for us to follow and let them lead us. And that's the way Ronald Reagan was, led us astray. And this is the way apparently this George Riley thing is going to be. She's going to get more prominence. And I keep coming back to this because it's such a shoe-in type situation. The people she's up against are real numbed down people. And she's saying all the right things. Ugh. Anyway, when bringing together such a diverse group of individuals and organizations, and bearing in mind the magnitude of technological, eco-social, and cultural changes that will be required to achieve a sustainable civilization, It is obvious that we are faced not only with a diversity of points of view, but also, as has become apparent since the Earth Summit in Rio, with much disagreement and some conflict. What goal and which path are in humankind's best interest? North, south, east, and west, people, governments, religious groups, and the private sector naturally have their own agendas, their own assumptions, beliefs, suspicions, fears, and hopes for the future. On the one hand, now that the Cold War is over, most of the world's 285 governments seem to have embraced the concept of free trade as a panacea for all their problems and have advocated much of their sovereign power in favor of the World Trade Organization and transnational corporations. New markets are opening up around the world, business is booming, and profits are at an all-time high. On the other hand, a growing number of individuals and organizations agree that the economic goals of world development and trade policy must be counterbalanced with those of ecological sustainability and social equity. The development of a sustainable civilization, they argue, requires less mercenary approach in which local communities take on more, not less responsibility for the issues which affect them. And boy, I'll tell you, that's a Trojan horse, people. It cannot be denied that globalization has many negative consequences, they say, including diminished social safety nets, reduced ecological protection, increased unemployment, and runaway inequity between rich and poor. According to the Human Development Report of 1997, published by the UNDP, the net worth of the 10 richest people on the planet in 1996 was $133 billion, which is over 1.5 times the combined national reserves of the 48 least developed countries. They go on to state with 2 billion of the world's population now living below the accepted poverty level and 35,000 children among them dying of starvation every day. This inequity creates growing resentment, social disintegration, crime, anti-democratic ethnic nationalism, religious fundamentalism, and social chaos. Oh my. Well, you're getting the picture of this to a certain extent. They talk about the issue of consumption brings up a basic contradiction between perception and reality, which becomes apparent when world development and trade policies are analyzed in the context of the carrying capacity of the Earth's biosphere, upon which the survival of our species depends, they say. The environmental economist William Rees, a member of our Global Vision Advisor Group, has developed the science of ecological footprint analysis to quantify the nature of this problem. And isn't that amazing? In his excellent paper, Revisiting Carrying Capacity, Area-Based Indicators of Sustainability, William Rees defines the ecological footprint concept as follows. Human populations necessarily appropriate the ecological output and life support functions of distant regions all over the world through commercial trade and the natural biogeochemical cycles of energy and material. What a mouthful. Indeed, the annual flows of natural income required by any defined population can be called its appropriated carrying capacity. Since for every material flow, there must be a corresponding land or ecosystem source or sink, the total area of land water required to sustain these flows is on a continual basis as the true ecological footprint of the referent population on the Earth. My God, did anybody understand any word of what that was? What I just read to you? This guy Rees goes on to point out the paradox. The current objective of international development is to raise the developing world to present first world materials standards. To achieve this objective, the Brundtland Commission argued for more rapid economic growth in both industrial and developing countries and suggested that a 5 to 10-fold increase in world industrial output can be anticipated by the time world population stabilizes sometime in the next century. And this was done in 1987, people. Let us examine this prospect using ecological footprint analysis. If just the present world population of 5.8 billion people were to live in current North American ecological standards, a reasonable first approximation of the total productive land requirement would be 26 billion acres. However, there are only just 13 billion acres of land on Earth. And we're talking about acres, H-E-C-T-A-R-E-S. I just don't know what that is. H-E-C-T-A-R-E-S. See, the lingo of the UN system is designed to confuse. And it's tough to deal with this here, people, because where is it going to take us? Where is this going to take us? I have something that I've saved for you right now, and I have a lot of articles from the newspaper that's very relevant, as it always is, but I'm trying to pinpoint something right now that connects some dots that are very, very important. And with that knowledge, let me find it. This is very appropriate to what I was covering. Tom DeWeese, on the 6th of August, wrote this. And he's evidently the president of the American Policy Center. He says, "My friends, we come here today from many walks of life. A wide variety of reasons got each of us started on the road to activism. Some of us started simply because we noticed something funny about our child's curriculum in school. Some of us were outraged by government trying to take away our guns. A good many of us suddenly found government agents and members of private groups plotting to take away our land. Some have had their livestock confiscated. Some have found themselves facing jail just for doing what their fathers and grandfathers have done on the same land for decades. Some of us just wanted to be allowed to go to church, pray to God, and celebrate Christmas without being fined for it. A few of us would even like to be able to go to a restaurant and order food we like, even if it is greasy, fattening, and full of carbs and calories. All of us just want to live in an America where our rights and pursuit of happiness is protected. And so we fight. And now we found ourselves here today in a room with hundreds of others in the same boat. I have one thing to tell you. You're not going to win because the other side has cut us up into little pieces. They've divided us and conquered us. They've succeeded because you think your fight is against gun control, because you think your fight is against bad schools, because you think your fight is against the Endangered Species Act and roadless programs and wetlands regulations and water rights and heritage areas. Because you think your fight is against Democrats and not Republicans. Because you think it's a fight between evil liberals and good guy conservatives. You're wrong. Your fight is against a well-planned, well-orchestrated agenda for the complete transformation of America. And unless you learn that fact now, today, unless you fully educate yourselves to every aspect of that agenda and fight it on the proper terms, then you cannot win. I'm here to tell you that every one of these issues you are facing is interrelated. There is an agenda being implemented before your very eyes. It's called sustainable development. And I will tell you now, if you want to keep your guns, your property, your children, and your God, if you love liberty, then sustainable development is your enemy. So what is sustainable development? Imagine an America in which a specific ruling principle is created to decide proper societal conduct for every citizen. That principle would be used to conquer everything you eat, what you wear, the kind of homes you live in, the method of transportation used to get you to work, the way you dispose of waste, perhaps the number of children you may have, even your education and employment decisions. Sustainable development is that ruling principle for the implementation of what former Vice President Al Gore said we must all suffer through in order to purify our nation from the horrors of the 20th century's Industrial Revolution. In his book, Earth and the Balance, Gore called it a wrenching transformation of society. Quote, a wrenching transformation of society, end quote. Those are pretty powerful words that could concern anyone who values liberty. It's a warning that the rules are changing, that a new power elite is taking control. Perhaps you are beginning to notice such changes as you go about your daily routine, but haven't understood where those changes and the ideas behind them are coming from. But sustainable development is a very difficult concept to grasp. It's written in an almost foreign language designed to mislead and refrain from alarming you. Let me put it in the simplest language I possibly can. The Atkins diet is not sustainable. Now, why do I say that? Because on page 350 of the UN's Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, it says that the grazing of livestock, including cows, sheep, goats, and horses, is not sustainable. One reason for that concept is because sustainableists contend that the animals pollute and damage the banks of streams. Getting us to stop eating beef is a major effort needed to fully implement the sustainable agenda. Since they are cowards who fear your reaction to an outright banning of eating meat, they have to try to trick you into thinking that not eating meat is your idea. So they use scare tactics. For years, they have told you that eating meat raises your cholesterol. Fat is bad for you. Meat causes heart attacks. With PETA's help, they were succeeding in turning us all into little sissies eating salads. Amazing. Well, let's stop here. We've got to take a break. We'll stop here and continue with this direction with Tom DeWeese. It all makes sense, and this is why I'm covering it tonight. We have much to cover. A whole lot of things, including state tops mental illness ranking from the Oklahoman. We'll be back.
what in the world is going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first, and on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
How long were the days back in Genesis? Find out next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Silently, a huge, powerful form slides through the deep, cold, dark depths of the sea. The men aboard the nuclear submarine have seen neither sun nor daylight for months, yet each knows what day it is. The men know what day and even what time it is without even seeing daylight, because the sun's movement, like our clocks, only measures time. It doesn't make it. God doesn't need the sun to measure time either. When he tells us in Genesis chapter 1 that he created everything in 6 days and rested on the seventh, we know these days, like ours, even though the sun was not created until the fourth day. Some people wonder whether the days of Genesis chapter 1 could be figurative days. Well, the best interpreter of Scripture is Scripture itself. And what does it say? The word translated day in Genesis chapter 1 is the Hebrew word yom, Y-O-M. Whenever that word is used anywhere else in the Old Testament with a number, like 10 yoms, it always means a 24-hour day. And whenever yom is used anywhere else in the Old Testament with the phrase evening and morning, it always means a 24-hour day. Going back to Genesis 1, we see that the Holy Spirit has made sure that both of these rules are in force to assure us that the Genesis days are like our own.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com or give us a call at 1-800-42-BIBLE and join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
If you can hear my voice, you are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. If you would like to continue hearing these programs, there are several ways that you can help. One, you can make a donation or subscribe to your favorite program by going to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and follow the instructions there. Two, you can sponsor your favorite program with your business advertising dollars or spend your dollars with those businesses that advertise on your favorite programs. Three, simply call in on live programs and tell them that you are listening on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Now anyone can do that one. You can find the call-in numbers on our schedule pages at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. And finally, you can call 559-733-5002 and leave your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening.
Pokerface.com is their website. AmericanExpose.com is my website. American spelled with a K on purpose. Getting back to Tom DeWeese's dissertation, getting us to stop eating beef, and I'm reiterating the last paragraph before we went to break. Getting us to stop eating beef is a major effort needed to fully implement the sustainable agenda. Since they are cowards who fear your reaction to an outright banning of eating meat, they have to try to trick you into thinking that not eating meat is your idea. So they use scare tactics. For years they have told you that eating meat raises your cholesterol, fat is bad for you, meat causes heart attacks. With PETA's help, they were succeeding in turning us all into little sissies eating salads. Then along comes Dr. Atkins, who shows us that a low-carb beef diet will help you lose weight in a healthy way. Suddenly, the nation has gone Atkins crazy. Beef sales are skyrocketing. The sustainabilists are in a tailspin. They've lost control of your eating habits. Now watch what they are doing to get you back on the track. Suddenly, reports are being published in leading women's magazines about Atkins being dangerous to your health. Lawsuits have begun to pop up against the diet. Do you see how it works? That's how the Sustainable Development Agenda is implemented. Behavior modification based on fear. Freedom of choice is not part of sustainable development. And so I repeat, the Atkins diet is not sustainable. Now, perhaps you'll understand why there are sustainable development papers, guidelines, and regulations to impose the ruling principle on our public education system to prepare our children to live in a sustainable world, on our economy to create partnerships between business and government, making sure business becomes a tool to help implement the policies, on the environment, leading to controls on private property and business, on health care. The new drive against obesity is leading directly towards controls on what we eat. On farming, sustainable development policies affect farmers' ability to produce more crops by regulating or banning precious chemicals, biotechnology, and genetic engineering in the name of environmental protection. On our social and cultural environment, where political correctness is controlling policy hiring practices, immigration policy, multiculturalism, and marriage laws, etc. On our mobility, with emphasis on carpools and public transportation, and away from the freedom of personal transportation. And on public safety, where the rule of law and the court system is being challenged by new regulations that affect the right to privacy and unreasonable search and seizures. It's important to understand that these leading issues we face today are not just random concerns that find their way into the forefront of political debate. They are all interconnected to the policies of sustainable development. And you must understand that sustainable development is the official policy of the government of the United States of America in every state, city, and small burg in the nation. It is completely bipartisan. It is being equally implemented by Republicans and Democrats. No matter the outcome of any election, the sustainable development agenda moves forward unabated. What we are telling you here today, my friends, is that sustainable development isn't just some land use policy. It is a complete transformation of American society away from the rule of law, away from the ideals of property ownership, free enterprise, free travel, and even free association. Sustainable development, it's a life plan planned by someone else, not you. And sustainable development is not a myth or a theory or a conspiracy, as I've heard some in our own movement call it. Since the 1970s, literally hundreds of issue papers, charters, guidelines, and treaties have been presented at scores of international meetings, each becoming a building block in the creation of what would eventually become sustainable development. Finally, in 1992, the UN's Earth Summit in Brazil brought all these ideas together in two major documents called Agenda 21 and the Biodiversity Treaty. Here the ideas were officially presented to world leaders that all government on every level needed to be transformed into top-down control over housing, food production, energy, water, private property, education, population control, gun control, transportation, social welfare, medical care, and literally every aspect of our lives. To get the full picture, add to these the UN's Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, both of which create UN mandates on abortion, child rearing, and government interference on families. In 1993, President Clinton created the President's Council on Sustainable Development. From that council came a flood of policy papers and recommendations to enforce it as government policy. And the Clinton administration didn't need Congress to get into the act. All cabinet officials had to do was change some wording of existing programs and reroute already approved funding to begin to implement the agenda without Congress and without debate. Former Commerce Secretary Ron Brown told a meeting of the President's Council that he could implement 67% of sustainable development agenda in his agency with no new legislation. Other agencies like Interior, EPA, HUD, and more did the same thing. To help it along, Clinton issued a blizzard of executive orders. The American Heritage Rivers Initiative was born that way. So were roadless policies designed to stop logging in national forests. National parks have become core biosphere reserves designed to shut out any human activity. And the buffer zones around them are designed to shut off existing human activity, allowing the core to continually grow like a cancer tumor. Any possible exercise to control human development or activities began to sprout up. From rails to trails, bikeways, a wetlands regulations, to historic preservation projects, endangered species, real or made up, have been used to close down industry and steal private lands. Valuable nature or natural reserves have been locked away in national parks and preserves. In this way, an international agenda to transform the world into global governance under sustainable development policy took hold and became official policy of the United States of America. All by Tom DeWeese, very well stated, exactly what I say, and I agree wholeheartedly with what he says, listeners, and it's a serious time. We have a caller, I believe it's Dave in California. Dave, welcome to the broadcast.
Yeah, how are you? There are a couple of things about this. I've got to disagree and agree. One thing is, where I would agree, is that I believe it was Teddy Roosevelt was the one who put together the national parks.
Right.
And he essentially did that so that he could see to it that, you know, he and his buddies would be able to keep the land so that they could essentially rape it in the future. And they took it out of tax production and a whole lot of different things, and just so they could essentially use it. And so, you know, there are aspects about the development of the national parks that are real troublesome. But at the same time, the concept of sustainability, there's a lot of good to it, and there's a lot of common sense. I don't know if you're familiar with the problem of the Irish potato famine. You've heard of all of that problem back there in England a couple of hundred years ago?
Actually, no.
Well, it's real famous that the British had made a colony of Ireland just as they had made a colony out of the United States. And they had essentially, in fact, this is still going on. Whenever we hear about starvation down in Ethiopia and Bangladesh and a lot of other places, some of those places are the best land in the world, the best agricultural land in the world.
Ethiopia,
I mean, they thought the Garden of Eden for many, many centuries was in Ethiopia because it was so lush.
Uh-huh.
And so many of these big corporations have bought up all of the land in Ethiopia. They make more money selling that food in Europe than they do selling it to the Ethiopians. And so there's starvation. You know, same is going on with Brazilian rainforest and all through Mexico and Bangladesh is another clear example. There's the erosion coming out of the Himalayas is washing down into Bangladesh and leaving more and more and more topsoil And so for maybe 10,000 more years, they're going to have increasing quality of topsoil, but these agribusiness corporations own all the land, and they make more money selling food to Hong Kong than to sell it to the Bangladeshis. So there's starvation there, even though they have some of the best quality soil in the world. And so the same thing is going on in the United States. And this idea of, say, for example, you were talking about meat production. You know, they've talked for years about how they don't eat cows in India. And the idea of, what is it, I think a cow has got to eat 30 or 40 pounds of corn in order to produce 1 pound of meat. And so if you were to make cattle production in India, you would guarantee starvation for about 20 or 30% of the population.
Well,
you would take that much corn out of production.
Well, actually, cows can eat right off the land, you know.
Well, I understand that, but they still have to have vast acreage in order to make as much meat as it would. You would take 30 or 40 pounds of forage or something else to,
you know,
of meat.
Being out here in Oklahoma and seeing other parts of the world, there's plenty of vegetation for cows to eat off of. They don't have to. The only reason they're eating corn is because they're confined to eat corn.
Oh, I understand that.
Yeah.
But still, they're taking. You know, one of the big scams about agribusiness is that, you know, the corn that's produced here in America is usually not eaten by Americans. It's sold to the UN because most of the corn that the U.S. eats is bought from places like Mexico, Brazil. Countries of the world where it's, you know, they can pay people a dime an hour or a dime a day to produce it, and the American farmer demands, you know, $50 or $100 a day. And so there's no way that the American farmer can stay alive, stay sustainable, you know, when they've got to compete against a dime a day in production with
right.
business.
So right.
the idea of sustainability is trying to get those numbers to match up. And when you've got agribusiness that can essentially buy legislators, they can buy dictators, they can buy, the God almighty, the barge traffic and the shipping of, you know, the freight, the hauling out of, you know, New Orleans and the other shipping centers of the world where all the grain goes down to New Orleans and gets shipped out, to other parts of the world. And it gets essentially sold to the United Nations so they can feed the starving people that we're stealing the food from.
Well, isn't this as a result? Since 1945, the creation of the UN system?
Maybe not quite that far back. I mean, the scam, the UN, as far as I'm concerned, the UN got started as a good idea, but it got raped probably within 10 years. And
well, the point is, before the UN, you had the League of Nations.
Oh, yeah, and the same thing held true then. Because, see, if you look at the scam that the fat cats have been pulling on the world for centuries, is that they make money with currency exchange. They love wars because essentially they can play hatred against nations with PR.
Yes.
For example, you know, if I want to, let's use an imaginary that the United States was going to go to war against Canada, and so 10 years before that, you would start a campaign and you would play this thing where. The Canadians are horrible, 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 and you would say that so often and so loud that the currency exchange would fall, and then these currency speculators would buy Canadian when it was real low. Then they would praise Canada, let the exchange come back up, and let the Americans take it in the shorts. Then they would play it both, you know, they'd stir it up again, and then
mm-hmm.
they'd sell high and buy low, and they just keep doing that back and forth, and it goes on for a decade or so, and everybody loses, all the average people lose, because they've got to deal with real money, but the people that are running the ad campaign, you know, they cash in. Every time the exchange rate falls, they buy low and then sell high. And it's all a PR campaign, and they start wars like this, and they did this long before, you know, the turn of the last century. So the League of Nations was designed in some way so that it would prevent that, so that you could have the nations, the world, sitting around a table and saying, hey, look here, some guy's pulling, because there are a lot of, individual people who were pulling that stuff. They weren't doing it in the name of a nation. They were just, you know, arms merchants and speculators who were doing that in order to cash in, you know, on the currency. And so the idea of a League of Nations was that you could have the diplomats sitting around and trying to calm things down so that the exchange rates wouldn't dance to the tune of these PR guys. And so the League of Nations was torn apart right away because a lot of these guys were still in charge after Woodrow Wilson, and they tore it apart as quick as they could. And then the United Nations got going, and I think it was probably because of the atom bomb the United Nations has stayed at least more stable than the League of Nations did. You know,
well, actually what happened was the Second World War was a United Nations operation.
Well, some people would say it's the corporate state's operation. There's a lot of different speculation about this and that, because the UN really didn't exist until, what, 45, I guess?
Well, officially in 45, but unofficially on January 1st, 1942, and this comes from the Avalon Project at Yale Law School.
I can look that up, yeah.
It's a declaration by the United Nations, January 1st, 1942.
Okay.
And it's...
Hitler was from, what, 33s, got elected, but there were backers of him way into the 20s. And he was, you know, backed up by not only the Bush family, of course, but the Prudential Life Insurance, Citibank, Rockefellers. There were IT&T, AT&T, there were dozens of big American companies.
Absolutely.
Ford, yeah, they loved the idea. I don't know if you've ever looked at the structure of the corporate state, but it's, you know, we always hear about Hitler and this master race kind of con job, but the corporate state is the con job that's being pushed today, and it's that these guys are so wise and so skilled. These are corporations that know how to manage our lives, and they know how to manage the lives of the people better than the people do. And so they just that's how they're pulling this scam today. You know, they pull these Enron scams and all of their huge financial scams, and they get away with it because with their stolen money they bribe Congress. We the people have got to figure ways that we either boycott them, we got to get that money back out of their hands, we got to, you know, elect people that are not bribed by them.
Maybe not lawyers.
Well, whoever it is, we got to just keep changing it out. You know, I mean, people were talking about term limitation a couple of years ago, you know, and that sounds good, but the reality is that we need skilled and educated people in there, who are good talking to both sides, and
mm-hmm.
you can figure out what's really going on and pay attention to history, and so we don't make these same bonehead mistakes year after year after year. But these, you know, like I was saying, sustainability, I wouldn't be, you know, shouting about everything as sustainability is bad, because, you know, when I called in first, I was going to give you an example of what happened in Ireland. With the potato famine, we just, you know, we're given this history idea that they were eating nothing but potatoes, and then they had a couple of bad years, and it poisoned and starved everybody. But the reality was the British owned all of the good farmland out there, and they were harvesting everything and then shipping it to England.
Wasn't that against the wishes of the people of Ireland?
Oh, yeah, yeah, and there were food riots, and there were, and the British would come in there with troops, and since it was a short, you know, few miles across that strait, they were able to keep the British were able to keep the Irish down.
It's amazing how the British Empire has been the way it's been over the centuries.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But
where it is today, even.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you hear, you know, the further away you are from London, if you were a colony, the further away you were from London, the better chance you were of surviving, because they'd have to send troops that far. Like in India, you know, they actually made it against the law to make your own salt. You couldn't go down to the ocean and make your own salt. And there was a famous section with Mahatma Gandhi where he walked to the ocean and started making salt, and went down to the famous old salt production facilities, and they they just, you know, with passive nonviolence, started walking up to the gate, and those guys just clubbed them down, just beat the holy, you know, I don't want to start using cuss words.
Right.
They just clubbed them and tossed them in ditches, and for hour after hour, these people would just walk up, get clubbed, and it was probably the biggest pile of bloody, bruised bones, in the history of the country, but this was in the early days of movies and stuff like that, and these journalists were writing about how courageous these people were to just walk up and get whacked on the head with a club and tossed in a pile just because they wanted to have some salt. And, this idea of London demanding that they get the monopoly on salt for a nation of a half a billion people or a billion people or something like that, I mean, this is just craziness. And
yeah. Now, aren't you talking about more and more consolidation of power?
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the whole con job of the corporate state. Because you look at the structure of the corporations. In fact, have you seen this new movie called The Corporation?
No. Is that the one with Mel Gibson?
No. It's
Tom Cruise.
No, it's actually a documentary. Man, it's amazing. It goes into detail about it. It's as long as a feature length film, but it's really well done. It does it first of all just as a structure of a corporation. You know, what is a corporation? And takes some of those old training movies of the 50s and 30s and stuff like that, and then it goes into the more detail, and it takes like a psychiatrist to look at the structure of a corporation, where the corporation has all of the responsibility or enhancements, the abilities of a human being, but it takes no responsibility. So it essentially is just like this eating machine that just says, "I need more money. I need more money," and it doesn't matter what it needs the money for. It doesn't matter what it does. Pollution, they never clean it up because the bottom line is to make more money. They take no responsibility. So they take these psychiatrists and they look at the corporate structure, and they take the definition of a psychotic. You know, and a psychotic by definition is a person who believes that the laws are for other people and not for them. And so a psychotic is like this, a person that's got almost like a god complex. They believe that everything revolves around them and that everybody is supposed to dance to their tune no matter what.
Uh-huh.
And so the structure of a corporation is exactly that. So when you were talking about centralization, the structure of a corporation is that they get all of the Bill of Rights that we get as a human being, but they have no responsibilities. So they have the right to poison. They have the right to, freedom, the courts and the freedom of speech and everything else that we think of as good about the Bill of Rights, but they have no responsibility for their actions.
Why don't you hold yourself over and we'll continue on the other side if you don't mind, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll continue with this dissertation. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is what I say.
Suffer from gingivitis, sore and sensitive gums, bad breath, canker sores? Use Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash for healthy mouth and gums. Order now. Call toll-free 1-888-558-8482. That's